Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, China's relationship with the Western world, with much of the Western world, is under increasing strain. Just this week, two Australian government ministers, Foreign Minister Maurice Payne and Defence Minister Linda Reynolds, headed off to the US to meet with US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and other senior US defence officials to discuss, amongst other things, finding ways to counter China and its growing influence. Over the weekend, it was announced that Australia announced that China's territorial claims in the South China Sea were unlawful, although Australia is still planning to steer clear of participating in American plans to conduct so-called freedom of navigation patrols in the disputed waterway. Are you among those who are deeply concerned about what's going on here and the drift towards open conflict, as it seems? Or is it just an example of the US posturing in a presidential election year? It's an aspect of Australia's increasingly fractured relationship with China. Issues around foreign interference, Hong Kong, and indeed COVID-19 are all in the mix. Let's talk to a couple of China experts to try and make sense of it all. Richard McGregor is a senior fellow at the Lowy Institute and the author of a number of books on Chinese politics, including last year's Xi Jinping, The Backlash. Richard, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip.
Terrific to have you with us. Also joining us, Dr. Jeff Raby. Jeff was Australia's ambassador to China between 2007 and 2011. He was appointed an officer in the Order of Australia last year for distinguished services to Australia-China relations. His long experience with China is well known. His forthcoming book is called China's Grand Strategy and Australia's Future in the New Global Order. That's out in November this year. He's also a regular contributor to the Australian Financial Review. Jeff, good evening to you, and welcome aboard to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip. Delighted to be here.
Yes, no, terrific to have both of you with us. Jeff, I'll start with you. I mean, what words would you use to describe the Australia-China relationship at the moment? What's the best adjective for it?
Very poor. At its lowest state, as you said, since 1972, when diplomatic relationships were first established.
Yeah, so it's about the low. We're at rock bottom. We're at rock bottom, aren't we?
Yeah, and maybe it can still get worse. I mean, I gave an oration at La Trobe University last year saying it was the rock bottom, and it's deteriorated ever since then, so who knows.
Hmm. Is China's relationship with the US much different to ours, do you think?
Well, it's a very different relationship. I mean, the US is a great power, China's a great power. The key thing to understand about China and the US is really that the US is the dominant power and China's the ascendant power. This is challenging US global leadership.
Hmm. At its core, Richard, is that what it's about? It's the rise of one power in the form of China and the fall of another in the form of the United States. And what we're seeing here is what is the behavior of great powers. That's what we're seeing. And they're behaving like great powers have always behaved.
Well, in a way, yes. I mean, I would say it's the rise of one power and the decline of another, not yet quite the fall, although it may come to that. But I think it's important to, you know, there's its component parts. It's multifaceted. There's US-China competition on trade. That might be the least of it, even though we've heard a lot about it. It's on technology. It's on economics, it's geopolitical, it's regional in the Asia Pacific, but I think it's also important to remember that it's also a contest of political systems. These are rival political systems, both of which in different ways, but particularly the Chinese, think that the other side is out to get them, or the Chinese think that the US wants to undermine their system of government. So it's, you know, and it's, of course, it's about raw power as well, but there's many other parts of it as on top of that.
Mm. One of the big questions, of course, that people often trying to figure out is what does China want? Richard, you say you don't have to look too far for the answer. It's part of, it's in a plan called China Dream 2049. Tell us about that.
Well, Xi Jinping's long-term sort of a plan for China's return to greatness. It's called the China Dream. There's various benchmarks, but it culminates in 2049, which will be the 100th anniversary of the establishment of the People's Republic of China. And really, by 2049, China should be have its sovereignty totally restored. That means Taiwan, South China Sea, the East China Sea, where they have disputes with Japan, perhaps even the Indian border, even though that's not quite so important. And they would also have a military on par with the United States, and an economy, and be a wealthy, prosperous country as well on top of that, which of course would make them by far the biggest economy in the world. So that's the aim for Xi Jinping.
Yeah, Jeff, who could argue with that? What's they are pursuing a dream of expansion in the sense that the United States has always felt was its alone.
Yeah,
what's the argument against what China is trying to achieve?
Yeah, no, look, I think your comment's very reasonable on that. I mean, why wouldn't they want to achieve that?
No,
I think the problem is for liberal democracies is that we don't like the form of political and social organisation that that governs China, and therefore we're very scared about a China that may seek to impose that sort of system on the world. My own view is, though, that China is not expansionary in that sense. That what they want more than anything else is territorial integrity. It could be defined as broadly as what riches just defined it, but not necessarily. And the continuation of the Communist Party's rule.
Hmm. Just on that point, I mean, is that it? It's not because some think, oh well, this is China wants to export its brand of centralized authoritarian control via the Communist Party structure. He wants to export that form of governance to the world. You say not necessarily?
No. I mean, in the last few years, Xi Jinping has talked about a China model in the face of clearly less well-functioning systems and the US is faltering in the last couple of years. But I don't think that really is the agenda. The agenda is to have a world for China, if they could create it, and I really think the ambition far exceeds their capacity to actually achieve it, is a world in which people will recognise the legitimacy of the Communist Party and China's interests and not give it grief. And so a lot of what we see that annoys us greatly, quite rightly, like Chinese interference and domestic politics and so on, is part of how Beijing hopes to shape a world that basically accepts the role of the Communist Party and China's pursuit of its own interests.
Hmm.
It's not an ideological. I mean, people talk about a new Cold War. This is not an ideological Cold War in the sense that the Soviet Union versus the United States was in the last Cold War.
Hmm. Richard, in relation to the two issues you mentioned, Hong Kong and Taiwan, they're different in a way. I mean, you might argue that given the fact that Hong Kong was wrested from China in a pretty morally indefensible conflict with the West, that the return of Hong Kong to China was probably always on the cards. Taiwan's a different matter, though, isn't it? I mean, Taiwan's an independent independent democracy. It's not part of China in that sense at all, is it? You're saying that the Chinese think, oh, yes, it is.
Well, yes, they do. I mean, Hong Kong and Taiwan are different in many ways, similar in some respects as well. Hong Kong obviously has already returned to Chinese sovereignty. The issue there now is China breaching an agreement it made with the UK after 1997 to, allow Hong Kong to run its own affairs other than defence and foreign affairs, and quite blatantly that's being breached at the moment. No, but Taiwan is different. Taiwan actually has never been part of the People's Republic of China. Remember, it was a Japanese colony, then there was the Chinese Civil War, and Chiang Kai-shek's Nationalist Party lost the Civil War and they fled to Taiwan and set up a government there.
Mm.
And so the Taiwanese these days, they might feel ethnically Chinese, but they don't feel Chinese in the sense of, that the Communist Party would like them to be. In fact, they identify themselves as Taiwanese, as an entirely separate entity. And the idea that they would want to be governed by the Communist Party is an absolute anathema. There's about 5 or 10% of people in polls will support that.
Hmm.
So Taiwan is a really difficult issue for Beijing to solve.
Hmm. It's a difficult issue for the West as well, isn't it, Jeff? I mean, in truth, it's been put to me by foreign Chinese observers in the past on here on the program that when push comes to shove, the Chinese can do what they want with Taiwan because no one in the West will really lift a finger to help them. Do you think that's fair?
Well, certainly the United States has congressional legislation that would require the United States to defend Taiwan. So
whether they would, though, of course, is another matter.
Well, it would be hard if China just did a... It depends on the circumstances. And it's very interesting. In 2005, Alexander Downer was asked this in a question by journalists. Would we invoke the Anzus Treaty if... war or conflict happened between China and the United States over Taiwan? And the point Downer made then, which is still valid now, it really will depend on the specific circumstances.
Hmm.
But if there were, for argument's sake, an unprovoked attack by China on Taiwan, I think the US would have no option and would react in some way. It doesn't mean direct conflict with China. The US could close all the shipping routes. And deny China access to crude oil and other raw materials like iron ore. But the problem is a problem for Beijing because it's not actually clear, to me at least, under what circumstances China could take control of Taiwan. And I think Richard's point is a very important one. In my view that both Taiwan and Hong Kong, the current generation of leaders in Beijing have lost the young generations in both countries. Previous generations of Taiwanese used to look to the mainland as home and thought of reunification, albeit under the KMT, not under the Communist Party. But I think the young people, as Richard said, have a completely separate identity of Hong Kong, and it's the same in of Taiwan, and I think it's the same for Hong Kong.
Hmm.
The young generation want none of this with Beijing.
Richard, how much of what is going on right now, we've seen the closure of the Chinese consulate in Houston in the United States. The Chinese immediately retaliated by closing one in regional parts of China as well, the US embassy, that is in a tit-for-tat move. How much of what's going on is part of a presidential re-election year, and how much of it is a real pivot by the military establishment and the defence establishment in the United States against China?
Well, without sitting on the fence, it's really both. I mean, politics is always with us, and politics is always with us, especially in a presidential election year. I think the closure of the Chinese consulate in Houston had a great sort of Trumpian theatricality about it, which the current US president is good at. I mean, they said it was... an epicenter of espionage spies. But in the past, if you catch spies, you throw the spies out. You don't close the whole consulate down. I think Trump is blowing it up in an election. But I think generally speaking, whoever was in power in the US would be upping the ante on China. And this is one reason, by the way, that I don't think you can expect to see US and China relations getting better, even if Trump loses, because I think the defense and foreign policy establishment, as you call them, maybe the deep state, as others call them, they think that the US is late to the game with China. They think that they've had their eye off the ball on the strategic game that China's been playing. So they want to up the stakes while they're still more powerful than China and try and regain the initiative. And, of course, on the Chinese side, under Xi Jinping in particular, there's no taking a backward step. And as I mentioned, the competition is multifaceted.
Hmm.
So it's going to go well beyond whatever happens in the presidential
election. Well, what does that actually mean? This is what puzzles me, I suppose. I think it puzzles and also unsettles many people. What does that mean, we're upping the ante here? I mean, are we talking about what? I mean, we're talking about sending warships into the South China Sea. Are we talking about some sort of military standoff? Surely not.
Well, I'm not so sure there's going to be a war, if that's what you get to, but there's certainly the chances in the South China Sea of some sort of unforeseen incident is rising. In a more concrete sense, what does it mean? I think we're going to see is that we're heading to an era of so-called decoupling. In other words, the internet, China's internet and America's internet, will separate along with a lot of technology companies and the like. In other words, the other two, each country won't allow each other's sort of tech into their country. And of course, that will spill over to Australia. It already has with Huawei. In fact, we're very much alert to that issue. I think the, you know, so that's the big areas, is the tech separation, I think, and the chances of some sort of military conflict rising. And of course, the spillover effect to other countries like Australia, like Japan, South Korea, Singapore and the like. Increasingly, there's pressure on everybody else on all sorts of issues to choose sides. So it's a tougher world for everybody.
Hmm. Yeah, let's talk about that for a second. A lot of opinion polls suggest that China, back to the earlier question I asked you, Jeff, about isn't it legitimate for China to have aspirations to restore its territorial and economic status to what it was once in Asia, that is the dominant power, and that might be seen to be legitimate. But opinion polls seem to suggest that China's losing, not gaining respect in the West. Is that your read on it?
Yes. I mean, I regard China's vastly expensive propaganda, soft power exercise to project a certain image globally as being a complete a disaster.
You mean this is the Belt and Road Initiative, for example?
No, not the Belt and Road. I could deal with that separately. No, soft power through Confucius Institutes, through massive funding of CTV, Global Network, through print, radio, online, you name it. There is a massive investment. I describe it as amongst all the wasteful investments that the Chinese Communist Party has made, this is probably the most wasteful, the least successful. If you look at the Pew opinion polls of global attitudes towards China, I mean, it has gone backwards massively. And most people in the world regard China with a higher level of distrust than they did only a few years ago. And the reason for that is structural, and that is that China is unable to project soft power effectively because it all has to go through the Communist Party narrative. So it's structurally a problem of the Communist Party. I mean, Chinese traditional culture is very appealing and it has enormous reach and influence, but not the party state's attempt to project soft power. So that is a big problem.
What happened, Richard, with the old? I mean, this argument used to be run with some confidence, wasn't it, a decade ago, that as China liberalises and becomes more economically open, then political openness will follow. I mean, this was seen to be an inevitable progression. Of course, that has fundamentally not happened, and there's a quite different proposition emerging. Why didn't it happen in China?
Well, I guess basically the Communist Party ensured it didn't. Now, many people have dismissed this idea that you know, Bill Clinton talked about, maybe Australian leaders talked about as well, that China would inevitably come democratic as it became richer. But people look back on that now and say, oh, what a stupid idea that was, how naive they were. And maybe that's right, but I think actually the Chinese recognize it as a quite potent idea. They understood it could happen. They worried about it at the top of the Communist Party. So they worked to make sure it didn't happen. And I think what happened, I think we in the West were late to realize they'd kind of won that battle. In other words, you know, China, most Chinese, it's a complicated story, but the economy has done extremely well. The area that China does have soft power, if you like, is in development economics. You know, don't believe the people who tell you that Chinese economic growth is fake. It's not. And so the party has developed a great deal of legitimacy and has used their sort of grip on the propaganda system internally to reinforce support for them. And, of course, contrasting what they've done with the sort of chaos in the United States. So the idea that China might become a democracy, that's kind of, you know, nobody talks about that anymore. It wasn't dumb to talk about it back then, but I think the party, people underestimated the ability of the Communist Party to combat that and shunt it aside.
Mm. Jeff, just back to you on that same question too. I mean, there's often a view amongst, you know, ordinary people, I guess, in the West who look at China and think, oh, what, you know, what a terrible oppressed people who must be suffering under the yoke of this. But that's probably not how most Chinese feel about the Communist Party or their government, is it?
No, not at all. I mean, I think there's a very high level of support for the party. A recent research coming out of the Ash Center at the Kennedy School in Harvard, covering 12 years of their own polling, not official Chinese polling, shows that there's very high levels of support, and it's growing because it's a government that performs. But I do want to just go back on the previous point you raised with Richard, because I think it's extremely important. Certainly, as an official who was involved in the early years of the China-Australia relationship back in the early 80s and on from that, we never had a view that China was going to evolve into some sort of liberal democracy. Certainly the Americans did, but they take a much more ideological approach to foreign policy than, say, the Australians. What we wanted was a stable China, one that was prosperous, because obviously that offered us economic opportunity, but it also would not be a destabilizing element in the region, and we didn't want to be having to deal with a mass of Chinese refugees flooding out of a broken country. And in every respect, on the things that we really wanted out of engaging with China, we've achieved, and China's achieved. And it's a much more stable, a much more constructive place today than it was when the reforms began and we started to engage with China. So the Americans may have buyer's regret, and it's not generally across Americans, it's a small group of, I think, ideologically driven policy people, but we don't have buyer's regret in Australia. I mean, we never, ever approach China as if economic reform is going to beget political reform. In many ways, you need to think of China as reverting to very long traditional forms of political and social organization. I mean, the party state is not much different than the imperial system of China.
Hmm. Yes, no, exactly, a good point. Dr. Jeff Raby's our guest tonight, former Australian ambassador to China, and Richard McGregor also with us as well, senior fellow at the Lowy Institute, both gentlemen, long-time China experts and China watchers. We're talking about the current relationship with China. Richard, what's your take on the failure of Chinese soft power? Why haven't they convinced us?
Well, it's pretty similar to Jeff's, actually. I'll try and put it in a different way. You know, if you're used to you're a Chinese, you live in China, you're used to Chinese political language, the way the Communist Party speaks, you know, Marxist, Leninist jargon and the like, well, that's just what it is and what you've grown up with. But what works internally doesn't work externally. And we've had a classic case of that, I think, with COVID-19, where, you know, leaving aside what happened at the start, and I'd be happy to talk about that, but once China locked down, they did very well. And they propagated that message internally to people inside China. And I suspect it's gone down pretty well, particularly compared with the chaos in the States. But a similar sort of message once the Chinese diplomats went out into the rest of the world to tell everybody what a wonderful job China had done, it had the opposite effect. And you look at the opinion polling in Canada, in Australia, in the US, in the UK, in France and Germany, just about everywhere in the developed world, there's been this backlash against China. I think only two or three countries in Europe China's ratings have gone up, Serbia and Bulgaria from memory, maybe Italy as well. But it's simply because Chinese political language outside of China is a turnoff because I think people recognize it for what it is, an authoritarian voice speaking to them in a way which is simply not persuasive.
Mm. Jeff, back to that point you made, which is that Australian policy towards China was never that, oh, well, our goal here is to oversee the transformation of the Chinese economy into a liberal democracy. We never thought that was part of it at all. Is the current set of problems with China essentially that we are seen to be aligning with the United States here and that the Chinese don't have any particular beef with us?
Oh, look, China has behaved badly, particularly badly in recent years. Xi Jinping has become has taken China to a much more assertive, muscular area in foreign policy, domestically more authoritarian, Chinese diplomats have behaved badly. We've seen that in recent weeks. And people are responding to that. And the South China Sea probably is the lightning rod for all of that concern about China and its ascendancy. The problem really for Australia is that, as Hugh White said back in 2010 in the China Choice, at some point, the United States, as a dominant power, either has to cede strategic space to China as the ascendant power, or there will be conflict. And the United States started under Obama with the pivot to push back on China. But because of our alliance relationship with the United States, we will always go where the United States has gone. And that's what's happening today. And that is, I think, the problem, that the US has made the choice that it will push back on China. Pompeo is absolutely clear that the strategy is containment. Some while ago, you couldn't even use the word containment, but he's using it himself. And we are now, as Hugh White predicted back in 2010, finding ourselves having to make a very uncomfortable choice. And we've made our choice, and we've made our choice to align ourselves even more closely with the United States in the face of China's assertive, more muscular behaviour. So therein is the problem. And my own view is that's not actually where we need to be. We need to find a more independent foreign policy that navigates its way between these very difficult powers that are in conflict with each other.
Yeah, what's the way forward on that? I mean, Richard, maybe you would like a comment here too. What is the way forward on that? Because you could see, in a sense, the uncomfortable nature of the relationship with the United States and China on display in the recent meeting in Washington, where Australia's trying to say, look, we all have our own relationship with China. The United States is saying, yes, well, okay, here's an agreement. We've agreed to have to, you know, to set up a fuel dump in northern Australia. We've already agreed to host additional US forces there. I mean, are we being carried along, pushed along by the United States, despite what we might like to be doing?
Well, I think Australia is very uncomfortable with much of what Trump and Pompeo say. You know, Pompeo talking about containment, as Jeff said, Pompeo talking about China should know its place. But I don't think Australia sees any alternative in managing China other to have an engaged the US. And if you're going to engage the US, you're going to do stuff with them in Darwin and elsewhere. But I think it's also instructive to expand on that and the point that Jeff was making. Let's just, you need to expand it beyond US, China, Australia. You know, other countries in the region also have agency and also have a lot at stake. Japan, the most important one of all. And if you think about the idea about China naturally wants to be the most dominant country in the region. As you said before, there's nothing surprising about that. But it's not the same as America and Asia. And let me give you an example. China has territorial disputes in Asia with Japan, in a way with South Korea, with Vietnam, with Indonesia, with the Philippines, with little Brunei, and with Malaysia, all of different kinds. And America has none of those disputes. That's why America is so important in Asia. It is a dominant power. It behaves like a dominant power and the like. It's not going to be able to do that. But at the same time, if they left tomorrow, we would have a highly unstable and extremely unhappy region. You know, China is not ready to take over, and countries don't want them to. So that's why we're in such a difficult situation right now and why everybody's manoeuvring.
Jeff, who are China's friends? I mean, you kind of get the impression that they are lacking it. They're picking... or seem to be picking disputes. I mean, with big neighbours like India, for example, that's been a long-running one. I know who's China managed to bring on side with its ambitions.
Well, China's never had allies in a formal military sense, as we understand formal alliances. They've always had a very close relationship with Pakistan, and that's served China's purposes in terms of dealing with India and managing its Indian relationship. It's moved very, very closely to Russia, or should I say Russia's moved very closely towards China under the pressure of Western sanctions over Ukraine. And they're now conducting massive naval military exercises of all sorts. But China, I don't think, really cares a lot about having friends of that sort. It doesn't want people to give them grief. It doesn't want countries to give them grief. But it is a sense, in its sense, what it wants is territorial integrity and the Communist Party control and running the country to continue. But obviously it's going to balance others, and certainly Russia is very, very important in this. But, I mean, China's also very capable at neutralising opposition and much of the region, I think. I think a very important point Richard makes is that we're not alone in trying to deal with this. I think other countries in the Southeast Asian region have dealt with this perhaps a little bit more adroitly than we have. So everyone's got to deal with China. It's not going to go away. It's there. It's a dominant power in the region. It's not about friendship. It's about interests. And different countries line up at different times with different interests.
Mm. What about China and Iran? Where's that relationship and where might it go?
Well, China's very, very dependent on Middle East oil. It has a good relationship with Saudi Arabia, a good relationship with Iran. It's not a player in the Middle East in the same way that Russia has inserted itself into Middle Eastern politics. Sino-Iranian relations are very good.
Could I add something there, Philip?
Yes, Richard.
Well, I think just going back to the issue of friends, I think China does have one treaty ally, and that's North Korea. And I think it was Malcolm Turnbull who once joked that North Korea is the sort of ally you have when you're running out of friends.
Yes. I think it's a half tick and a half box, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think, you know, China, I guess, also has a lot of pretty good relationships in Africa. So if you look further around the world outside of the developed world club, but the Middle East is fascinating because if you look back to the two Iraq wars. Now, whether or not the US was going to war over oil or whatever, I'm not going to sort of attempt to relitigate that. Certainly, oil was a fundamental issue in America's relationship with the Middle Eastern countries. Now, these days, America exports energy, exports oil. It's China now that has the energy interests in the Middle East with Saudi. With Iran, they've just done a big sort of bilateral deal with Iran in which, you know, they'll give certain things to Iran, export certain things to Iran, and Iran will pay them back in discounted oil. You know, of course, the Saudis look at that and say, what's China doing with Iran? But it makes China much more vulnerable to what happens in the Middle East. And you've talked to some Chinese scholars these days, and they say, well, America now has an interest in instability in the Middle East because it would hurt Chinese oil supplies and they could sell more weapons. Now, that's a bit baroque, but it's not entirely untrue. So I think the Middle East and the interests of the Middle East and their relations with China are starting to change quite a bit, actually.
Yes, Jeff.
Jump in again. Sorry, mate. But, I think Richard makes a very, very good point there and also draws attention to China's massive vulnerability to resources and energy. It depends absolutely on global markets to keep itself going. So a lot of discussion about South China Sea and Straits of Malacca have to be seen in terms of the massive strategic vulnerability that China has by its dependency on oil and resources.
Mm-hmm.
And it all goes through those seas. And that's a very big part of the whole story around the South China Sea.
Okay. Can we talk a little bit about espionage? There's been a lot of stories over the last few years about China trying to infiltrate our university campuses and, well, political parties. The story of the Chinese property developer Huang Xiaomo, for example, who donated $100,000 illegally to the New South Wales Labor Party. There are plots to plant Chinese spies in Canberra. Some have suggested the Chinese would like to insert representatives in Parliament that they control. How seriously should we take these kinds of events, or is this just another example of the sort of soft power initiatives which aren't going so well, Jeff?
Well, I think because soft power doesn't work, China needs to use what we call as sharp power, the sorts of things you're describing. And China's not alone. I mean, many countries do these things.
I mean, the United States does this as well in foreign countries.
Israel, even when I worked for ministers in Parliament House, even Malta was running around influencing ministers to keep our embassy open in Malta, or the High Commission open. Look, no, I mean, the issue here, all this stuff goes on. The issue is context and proportionality.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, if you go back to the Four Corners program of, 3 years ago, outing Sandastiari and Chinese influence, we've had 3 years of the most intense scrutiny. And what have we come up with? I mean, Dastiari, some character in the New South Wales upper house, who I have to admit I don't know. I've never heard of him before. I actually don't think the threat is of the scale that we're told it is. There is a threat, and it's going to come from many countries, but China obviously is quite aggressive.
But is China really trying to do any more than insert friendly voices into the process in the same way that, I must say, the United States tries to do?
Yeah, well, it may, and it may be going beyond that. But is it undermining our institutions? Is it harming our parliament? Anti-foreign interference was a good idea. Politicians have to ask themselves why they didn't have it a decade or two decades earlier. And I think that, we know why, because they actually benefited from it. But we should harden all of our defences, but we shouldn't create a China threat. And as you say, others do it as well. So China might do it in a more ham-fisted way. It might apply more resources to it. But we mustn't lose sight of the strength of Australia's institutions, the free media, the parliament, all these things, the rule of law, defend us from this sort of thing. And I just think the whole thing is wildly exaggerated.
Okay. Jeff, can I just
I'm going to disagree a little bit there. I mean, obviously, there's espionage, there's influence, and there's interference. You know, the story of Mr. Huang Xiangmo, who's the guy who's been, evidence has been given about him, he's the one who gave money to Sandastiari, some of it in secret. He's the one who gave money, according to the evidence at ICAC in Sydney, in secret to the secretary of the New South Wales Labor Party. You know, if we hadn't responded, and of course when you react, sometimes you overreact, if we hadn't responded, he would have, this was a man who wasn't even an Australian citizen, who might have controlled one of the most powerful branches of one of our alternative government. And that's pretty amazing. I mean, where did this guy come from? Who was he working on behalf of? And you know, we still don't know that, but we do know that he was also head of one of the sort of semi-official Chinese associations, which was pushing with Sandastiari, the South China Sea issue and the like, and various things like that. So what's happened, there's always a bit of hysteria surrounding it. It's actually been, I think, very beneficial in making the institutions which Jeff mentioned as being so important more resilient. Because before we go out into the world, we have to sort of have an internal resilience here. And I think that's the process you've seen unfolding.
Jeff, what's the fuss about Huawei? To all intents and purposes, the Chinese telecommunications giant Huawei is a world leader in 5G mobile technology. Yet Australia was one of the first movers to say, not on your Nelly, you're not, despite the fact that you're the most competitive and technologically suitable candidate, you're not building 5G here in Australia. The UK's recently said they're going to tear it out there over a 10-year period. What's the problem with Huawei? Is it that the Chinese Communist Party are going to be listening in to telephone conversations in Australia or what?
Well, in a nutshell, that's the accusation the United States has made, and that's the line the United States has run for several years. Mind you, the United States is not in 5G. The only suppliers of 5G technology are two Scandinavian companies and Huawei. And you have to ask yourself, is there not an anti-competitive element to all of this? But if everything that's said about Huawei is true, and it may well be, I can't comment. I'm not an expert, and we don't have any access to what basis these decisions have been made on. There's no need for the Australian government to have done it the way we did it, in such a high-handed way, an announcement in Parliament, calculated to make Chinese face.
Well, it was highly insulting to the Chinese, wasn't it? Yeah.
And as many countries have done, they've found ways to use part of Huawei in their 5G network and exclude Huawei from more sensitive parts of the 5G network. A total blanket ban was a very big call on the basis of no publicly available evidence. It's interesting that the UK has had years debating this and actually came down to allow Huawei to participate in 30% of the 5G as Germany has made its system open to Huawei.
Hmm.
So, look, without knowing, you know, really what the basis of these decisions are, the diplomat in me comes out and says, well, look, it's how you announce these decisions, how you present them, how you manage these issues, not that you have to be the loudest voice or take the highest profile. And I think that's the issue that we have to look at in terms of how we've managed this relationship with China over the last few years. We don't have to be the first one out of the pack. We don't have to be standing on our own as we were when the Prime Minister announced that he wanted an inquiry into the Chinese origins of COVID-19. Do these things in company. Stay in the and not set out to provoke China on these matters.
What's your take on Huawei, Richard?
Well, I certainly agree with Jeff. We don't need to be the leader of the pack at all times. And I actually was quite critical of the way we managed COVID-19 inquiry. I mean, if you look at, we make statements on the South China Sea with Japan and the US, on Hong Kong, we've made them with Canada, the UK, the US and New Zealand. We often do things with other countries because it's a smart way to do it. With the COVID-19 inquiry, for example, we, for some reason, decided we'd do it ourselves. We don't have to do that. With Huawei, though, it's quite interesting. We were quite isolated on that, but actually the rest of the world is catching up to us. Huawei's out of New Zealand now, the US, obviously, Japan. I think they missed out on tenders in Singapore, even Italy, which is the most friendly country to China in Europe. The UK is tearing it out of their system. France, I think, has virtually said the same. Canada is likely to exclude it as well. Is there criticism about the way we've gone about it? I certainly have no access to the intelligence, but I think when it was announced by Scott Morrison, I think, as about the day before Malcolm Turnbull got knocked off or something, I think it was, I don't think we did make a big fuss about it. We just put out a statement, didn't name Huawei, even though everybody knew what it was about. You know, certainly China sees us as a ringleader and a pace setter. But I think in that case, you know, we were making the decision now, would it be any better?
Okay, let's take a call or two. Paul's with us. Paul, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well.
I'd like to ask, what is the panel's opinion on the selling of the Port of Darwin to, whether it's a Chinese government authority or an authority, fundamentally, if all the other issues are around, you know, China controlling a lot of its state-owned enterprises or a lot of the private enterprises like Huawei, why did we then fundamentally agree to sell a port under a 99-year lease to a government or a Chinese private or state-run authority?
This interests a lot of people. Jeff, in all honesty, if the decision came up today, I suspect it wouldn't happen, would it?
No way. But that's a problem, actually, because when the lease was signed about 3-4 years ago, the Department of Defense wasn't interested. There was no strategic dimension to this.
Mm.
I mean, what's changed is, well, partly the view of China as a threat, you know, more what's changed is that we've shifted our position to to one where we see China as a strategic competitor.
Yeah.
So these things are then viewed through the prism of strategic competition. And it wouldn't happen today because we've set up the whole FIRB or restructured the FIRB and have a critical infrastructure group basically to stop this ever happening again. But the point Darwin some years ago really wasn't seen as having any strategic value whatsoever.
Although we'd see it very differently. I'm sure you'd agree, Paul, we'd see it very differently differently now. Thanks for the call. Yes. Matthew, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Well.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask your guests, what do they foresee China playing a more important role in mediating the conflict between Iran and Israel? And I ask this mindful of the fact that Xi Jinping has in the last few years expressed support for the idea of East Jerusalem becoming the capital of a future Palestinian state.
Richard, do you have a view about this? Or whether China has a strategic interest in this dispute?
Well, I wouldn't wish on anybody the job of mediating between Iran and Israel.
No.
It's probably a loser's bet there. Israel is, you know, China has a very interesting relationship with Israel. Obviously, ideologically, they've always been much closer to the Palestinians. Your caller mentioned the talk about East Jerusalem there, but of course, economically and technologically, they're all over Israel and really sort of have tried to buy companies there, buy technology from there. And in fact, Israel has been under a ton of pressure from the US not to deal with China, because obviously Israel is a highly advanced country. So I don't see much of a role in the Iran-Israel mediation. They don't have the trust with both partners to really do that, nor I think do they have an interest in the short term. The more interesting part of that is to look at how Israel handles its relationship with China. China wants to get very close to Israel. The US wants to stop that happening.
Hmm. Okay, Kay, hello. Hi, Kay.
Hi. Yes, I am. Took in international students, mainly Chinese, from year 2008 to 2013, and what some of them told me that they had to be very careful with what they said and did because they were being spied on in this country by the Chinese.
Mm. Yeah,
so that's 12 years ago.
Yeah, and this is commonplace enough, isn't it, Jeff? I mean, I've had colleagues too from China who've been studying in UK institutions who have told me quite blatantly that they are spied upon, and that they're reported on constantly about what they're doing, and that this is something in a free and open and democratic society like ours that we should be concerned about.
Yeah, absolutely agree. It happens. It's again the sort of ham-fisted way the party state operates overseas, and it's something we should be concerned about, and we need to have robust defences against it, absolutely. And it's not to diminish it or to mitigate it at all, but when I used to teach economics at university in the 1970s in Melbourne, Malaysian students who filled the class, Malaysian Chinese, had the same concerns from the Malaysian government. Authoritarian-leaning states tend to do this to their students overseas.
Hmm. Just by way of conclusion, just back on a point that you made earlier, Jeff, that China's very dependent on resources, on oil, on raw materials. Australia is a huge producer of very high-grade and high-quality iron ore. In the end, is Australia... Is that economic relationship between us and China going to see us through some of these issues or not?
Well, I mean, you'd hope so, and it depends how far all of this runs. But we need to be very careful in Australia because iron ore is the most plentiful resource on the face of the earth. The trick is putting it in, getting into ports, getting into ships. We're very good at that, and the Pilbara is extremely well placed and it's only 8 days sailing. But Brazil has far higher quality iron ore than Australia, far more than Australia. And we are benefiting from two major industrial catastrophes in Brazil where two tailing dams collapsed, interrupting supply, and now COVID-19 in Brazil. So we've benefited massively over the last 3 years in terms of supply shocks in iron ore. It could well be that when Brazil gets its act together again, China may seek to divert sources of iron ore away from us to Brazil.
Richard, just in my way of a final comment, would a Biden presidency make a difference? Would it change the tone?
Well, you might have a more stable president, a more strategic president. I don't think there'd be a substantial improvement in the relationship. So the tone might be better. The relationship, I doubt, would be. One thing that Trump has done is actually at different times sort of destabilized, surprised China. You know, that's his sort of modus operandi. He mainly did that on trade with tariffs and the like. The Biden people might look at that and think, well, that might work for us, but they might do it in more national security areas. In other words, it might be, you know, much more dangerous. Is that the right word? Perilous way of going about it. So, yeah, not too much change.
Okay, well, war is unthinkable, as we know. So jaw is infinitely preferable, as has long been said. Thanks for your time, gentlemen. Dr. Jeff Raby, former Australian ambassador to China. Thanks, Jeff. And
pleasure.
Richard McGregor, a current senior fellow at the Lowy Institute as well. Richard, thank you for
your
time.
Thank you, Philip.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.